This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard, given on the 26th of June, 1961. The title of this lecture is Dealing with Attacks on Scientology. This tape is 63 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
You know, give her the applause. She's the one that's doing all the work. It's very funny. It's very funny. He never takes over his DP any place, but what they don't stack up PCs in all directions, you know, and all the cases crack, brrr, so forth. We haven't told people out in the field. Their cases would be personally supervised by Mary Sue in the running, or we wouldn't be able to hold the cars. That's the truth. I'm not. She's just depreciating now because she's running. I think the level she's running at the moment is failed to appreciate. What is this? 26th of June, 1900, and AD 11. Okay, I want to say a word here at first about tactics and strategy with regard to anti-Scientological activities. It might be of some benefit to you to know this. After all, I've been fighting this war now for 11 years, very often without very much help. Every once in a while, Scientologists tell me how reasonable it all is that somebody has a causeless belly or something of the sort. It isn't true. Our people are trying their best and they're doing their best, and I'm very proud of them. If we had anything at all to hide, we long since would have been blown out of the water with various salvos. All we had to do was have a few Achilles heels, and we would have had it. Well, we don't have Achilles heels, so recently the Better Business Bureau of Washington, D.C., wrote a letter, which is the most backwards letter anybody ever heard. Although many government agencies have tried to get something on this organization, none of them have ever been able to turn anything up. And can you imagine somebody writing something like this, you see? And as for Lafayette R. Hubbard, who is a principal in this particular organization, well, you can look him up in Dun and Bradstreet, and they just dismissed the whole thing. Well, they used to run an entirely different line of approach. They used to say, oh, they shoot people and kill babies, and they've been well known to throw people off top of St. Paul's Cathedral. That is their specialty. Anything ridiculous or stupid. The British Medical Association, by the way, has written letters to its doctors urging them to tell patients how bad we were and so forth. We've not had whispering campaigns. We've had loudspeaker campaigns going. But that type of backfire is inevitable. I call your attention to an essay on the circulation of the blood by a fellow by the name of Harvey, who was a graduate of the Royal Medical College of Physicians. He was, I think, a physician to the Crown. I think he was everything you could think of. And this man dared come up and say the blood beat not because of the tides of the body, but got pumped through a bunch of tubes. And he very carefully carried on a lot of experiments this way. And promptly, the whispering campaigns and so forth, which rose up around this, were fantastic. It tore the whole medical profession to pieces, about 1620 or thereabouts. Tore them all to pieces, ripped them up one side and down the other, and one doctor has heard to say, I would rather err with Galen than be right with Harvey, which is the most marvelous, I think, statement ever made in the controversy. Let's go back a little earlier. A short time ago, I was standing outside the prison of Socrates on Pnyx, I think the name of the hill is, in Athens, and it rather struck me as very peculiar that the story they have about Socrates in Athens is quite different than the story which we hear about Socrates in our own textbooks. And of course, there's always local information about various things which has a sort of a verbal tradition when they come on. And apparently, Socrates said that those gods of stone and marble and so forth didn't have much to do with the regulation of the universe, that man was basically a spirit. And so they finally tried him for heresy. against the pagan religion of the day and had him drink the hemlock. That's the local tradition about Socrates. It's not the story we read in the Encyclopedia Americana, Britannica, or anything, you see. But everybody got upset, because here was a new idea. But let me show you something. Today, people feel a pulse. They don't look at the sun to measure the tides of the body. They know very well there's body circulation. When somebody gets his arm cut, they put a tourniquet on it. Got the idea? This is a very well-accepted theory. Actually became a well-accepted, don't think these things take a long time, it became a well-accepted theory by about 1628. There was hardly a ripple by 1632. In other words, this has become an accepted idea. But in the first early years of its advance, there was an enormous amount of upset. Now, Socrates was henpecked and unfortunate in his choice of wives. And being so, of course, the man was emotionally unstable to some degree. And worrying all the time that he daren't be out talking in the club or the groves, you see, because he ought to be home, and he shouldn't be wandering around like this. He ought to be making a living like honest men do, and all this sort of thing. But anyway, he decided to give it up, and he gave it up, and the charges of heresy and so forth that followed with his relegation to the prison and all that sort of thing. Well, it is interesting that about a quarter of the people of Athens that particular night that he was put in jail were standing there with tickets bought on the nearest ship to Crete. See? People all over the place were trying desperately to get Socrates, who was not under very close arrest. His guards were very, very happy to turn their backs. They were trying to get him simply to walk down to the dock and walk up a gangplank. And everybody thought that this was what he would do. And he didn't. He stood around and said, well, for the principle of the thing, I ought to take this hemlock. He really made the government of Athens guilty, because that sort of thing, ordinarily, you see, didn't happen. They'd condemn somebody to death, and then the fellow would walk out the back gate and over the hills, and that would be it. It was actually a charge of banishment or something of this sort. But in his particular case, he had so many friends who would have paid his passage, who were trying to pay his passage that night, who were trying to get rid of these guards, who were trying to help him out, that they went into a total dismay. What is wrong with this man? Well, as I say, you make wrong marriages and you're liable to get all sorts of repercussions and suicidal impulses. So this thing about Socrates hasn't anything to do with the price of fish at all. Fact of the matter is that promptly and immediately everybody in Athens practically was talking Socratian philosophy, and have continued to do so ever since. His critique stayed as one of the primary philosophic modes right on up to the time when Kant overdid it. And this is a new idea, however, in a society. It's not necessarily attended by fatality at all. You hear a great many martyrs. But every time you find yourself a martyr, you find yourself somebody who is bound and determined, you see? What happens is, well, on the whole track, you may have been a tyrant yourself at one time or another, you see? And this fellow kept going out in the public square, you know, saying, Regulus III is a schnook, and he eats herring. And he does this just to popularize it so that the populace will eat it and he can collect the duty, you see. And herring is actually very bad for you and will rot your teeth, you know, and so on. And this fellow kept prowling around and telling people things like this. And I dare say that for maybe months and months and months, you keep getting a hold of somebody or sending some of your police or something like that to go see him and say, look, son, just lay off, will you? Skip it. You probably offer him a free passage to Gaul or almost anything you could think of, you know. and say, just go away and get lost, and so on. And eventually, well, he just kept saying, well, kill me then, if you believe this. And you had to. You got the idea? I mean, there's this idea of being so stuck on the idea that you have to get stuck on the spears. You see? But it's perfectly all right to be dedicated to a thing, but when one consistently fails to advance an idea, he feels then that he must commit suicide to further the idea. You got the idea? In other words, it's a failure to advance the idea which brings about this suicidal frame of mind. I imagine if anybody at all around Galilee had bought the Nicene Creed, I imagine Pontius Pilate, for a split sesterce, would have knocked that whole thing off, you know. But it was a failed idea. And he made it stick by proving it with suicide, right? Well, I've never been in a very suicidal frame of mind. It must be something lacking in my makeup or something of the sort. I believe first in making the idea effective. I don't believe in the idea that you should fail with an idea, you see? If you're carrying something forward, you're standing for something, you shouldn't be ineffective about it. You should go forward and carry out the idea. The object is not to fail at the idea and then make everybody guilty because they kill you. You got this. I'm not putting us in any category of any religious or philosophic lineup. I'm just showing you that new ideas are very often attended with tremendous success. Although we are taught carefully that people should martyr themselves for new ideas or sacrifice themselves for new ideas. And that's to prevent new ideas, don't you think? Would do so rather effectively, wouldn't it? So if you got enough philosophy abroad whereby that anybody comes up with a new teaching or a new idea is then martyred, if you've got that philosophy abroad, of course the old ideas are protected. And somebody sooner or later, Socrates or somebody, will fall for it. You know, you'll say, well, this is the thing to do, you know. I seem to be failing in getting this stuff across, so therefore I better commit suicide. Harvey, on the other hand, lived to a ripe old age, revolutionized the whole field of medicine. A few years later, his worst enemies were patting him on the back, saying, good boy, good boy. You remember when I was right in there with you. Now let's come up to more recent times. Of course, I'm talking about magnitudinous ideas because it's something about which we all know something about. Let's take a fellow named Albert Einstein. Of course, Einstein should have done some of his thinking in a private notebook. He shouldn't have been writing Franklin Delano that he could blow up Earth, which was in effect what he did. And then years afterwards worked all he could possibly do and gathered up all the funds he could gather up to wipe out what he had done with atomic fission. He organized organizations, societies, they maintained offices every place. The old man worked himself into a grave through having actually made a discreditable creation. Nevertheless, the actual course of history of Albert Einstein is quite interesting from our viewpoint. The man advanced a brand new theory of mathematics called relativity. There might even be some truth in relativity, who knows? At one time, a fellow by the name of something or other in the university at George Washington was holding his job as the chair of mathematics simply because he's one of the 12 men in the world who understood the theory of relativity. I went in to see him one day to interview him for the college paper. I wanted him to tell me something about this theory of relativity this fellow Einstein was kicking around with and so forth, and I never had such sneers, contempt, or was turned out on my ear quite so fast. You see? I turned out one on our mathematics department instead. Mathematics, has it come to stay? I think was the name of the article. You probably don't know the theory of relativity too well. You think you have a talking acquaintance with it because everybody's dressed it up now so that it fits with modern atomic physics. And you read textbooks and pocketbooks off the bookstalls all about the theory of relativity and so forth. Actually, the theory of relativity is that C is a constant. You can't go any faster than light. It brings up all kinds of wild surmises, such as if a man went the speed of light, he would then be as big as the universe, you see. and time would not exist if you were going at the speed of light. I mean, it's a whole bunch of fantasies and fairy tales is what this thing originally was. You see. Well, it had MGs equal Jaguar squares or something like that. As it's the primary modus operandi. And nobody could, of course, prove this fellow wrong because this C that he keeps throwing into all these equations, quantum mechanics and so forth, is not constant. Speed of light is not an exact constant, so therefore all these equations go a little bit wrong. So you never can quite prove it. It's very interesting. When they developed the atomic bomb, they did not use Einstein's theory. They put stuff in and out of a pile until they found that there was something called critical mass, and they thought that's very fascinating. They took it from there, and every atomic bomb you've got today was developed empirically. None of them were calculated. But he led the way, and it was a new idea and so forth, and the old man was sorry he did it. But what is actually the history of the Einstein theory out in the public? In 1928, a paper was read before the Combined Societies of Mathematics in Germany, and you can imagine how many people that was. The paper was the wildest piece of slander and libel that anybody ever heard. And it condemned the Einstein theory as the greatest mathematical hoax of all time. Einstein was in trouble with this theory for years. He was practically hounded out of jobs and universities, and everybody was on his back. And he finally went to Princeton and wrote Frankie, and we've got the atomic bomb. That's the history of the Einstein theory. But look at there. In spite of the fact it was a discreditable creation, the old man died with his boots on and the old retainers weeping around the bedside, you know? Oh, he's actually totally successful. There's no martyrdom connected with this at all, except he was sorry for having developed the atomic bomb. Now, what about many other creations of this character? Take Freudian analysis, for instance. Old man Freud, he got thrown on his ear by the medical association of his day, and they just gave him the yo-heave, and they wouldn't have anything to do with him, and they just raised the devil down around Vienna, and it just went on for years. And finally, about 1894, why, he made some startling statement and made a breakthrough. One character, he announced his libido theory in 1894. And from that time thereon, why, all was good roads and good weather. And look, the man had practically nothing to go on. He practically had no results. He practically had nothing but dreamed up theory and so forth. It was terrific. I mean, that he'd go so far, but he did have a new idea, and that is that man's physical ills could be assisted mentally. And that was a new idea, and that was the idea that Freud put into the world. But the old man died with his boots on, surrounded by the old retainers, weeping to see him go, you see? Sung the world around and very successful. This man was a very successful man, in spite of the fact that just before he died, he wrote a paper called Psychoanalysis, Terminable and Interminable. And he had learned that some people go on and on and on and on and on, and you just haven't seemed to do much about it. The paper and this sort of thing is now a woof and warp of our existence, and it isn't even true. 1894, and he was totally over the top by about 1933. That's very interesting, isn't it? There's an idea, the breadth of the world. But don't think the idea in its early stages wasn't thought. Harvey's ideas were thought. Galen, Socrates, any new idea gets thought. That's the nature of man, is when he sees something new, it threatens change. And man is a great believer in no change while he obsessively changes. While obsessively alterizing everything in view, he believes in no change. And of course, that's why he obsesses everything of this character. That's why his alter is so obsessive. It's because his basic belief is on a zero. All right. Now, I'm just talking to you about this, just looking coldly and dispassionately. What's the chances of Scientology of success? Well, we've been told it takes 100 years to get anything done. We've been told all sorts of discouraging tales, that it's martyrdom, that it's this, that it's that, it's the other thing. Nah, we're over the top. We're over the top. But we still get fought. And we're still in a period of being fought. And you can be fought with the velocity that you are right. Because then you are terribly dangerous. You think of the thousands of philosophies that must have come up since 1950. There must have been just libraries full of books written by people all over the place detailing theories about life. Where are these books? Where are they? They just don't exist. And right now the psychologist is changing his own textbooks, and all sorts of weird things are happening in the world. The medical profession now will tell you most glibly about prenatals, and we've long since forgotten them. But the point is we've made our incursion, but we threaten to upset far more than somebody's belief in whether or not the god was of marble or lightning, you see. We threaten to upset far more than that, if you're looking at it in terms of upset. The only reason it's safe for us to do any of this is because we can undo what we do. And Mr. Freud couldn't undo what he did. And Mr. Einstein couldn't undo what he did. And Socrates couldn't undo what he did. Let's take a look at this. You see? And they are all kind of sorry for it. They got into a suicidal frame of mind. But we're in a very safe channel, because we can undo what we did. Do you know that you can take somebody that's been very thoroughly badly audited and simply run the auditor off, and the auditing disappears? Why do you suppose that I include, and will continue to include in any security check, there's two reasons, questions about overts against myself? That seems an odd thing to do. Actually, there's two things. One, if a person has a lot of overts against me that he thinks is bad, he won't get any benefit from Scientology. That's quite obvious. He's got overts against the source. That's the thing. And you think basically that's the only reason that's there. No, there's another, much more subtle reason why you have to keep these overts off. The only way you could acquire a forceful, overwhelming valence called Scientology would be by piling up a bunch of overts and motivators on it. Think of it for a minute. Isn't that the way, basically, you got into any valence you're in? So this would be the first time that anyone was going along the track saying, all right, here's what I say, try it out, run me out. Did you realize that? So there's no overwhelm mixed up in this. In the early days, people who had been all mixed up with Taoism and all that sort of thing, they kept telling me that we needed tremendous aesthetics. You know, we needed the swinging incense pot and all that sort of thing. And these tremendous aesthetics, which we were supposed to have something to do with, of course, palled on me in the very earliest stages. Because I said, you can always overwhelm a Thetan with aesthetics. And we haven't the least desire to overwhelm a Thetan. So if you wonder why central organizations don't hire the Empire State Building, or we're not flat out to make a totally overwhelming ritual of it all, don't you see? That's all part of the same picture. If it's true for you, it's true. It's not true for you because we have overwhelmed you. It's a tremendous difference there. It was the first time this has happened to man, so of course it appears very dangerous and very strange. They could understand it if we were simply trying to overthrow the established church, established science, or established governments. Then they would understand us. And you probably find that we weren't being hard fought. Oh, well, oh, yes, those people, yeah, we understand them. Revolutionary group. One of the things which they're going to do is blow up Buckingham Palace and the White House. Yeah, that's what they're going to do. That's right, you probably find the cops coming around seeing you being quite chummy. I'm not kidding. Can't understand you. But to understand somebody who is basically has no evil motives. Every man who has been overwhelmed by what he considered evil valences asks himself this question. What's the pitch? What's the pitch? What's the pitch? He's totally frantic. You know, you audit this fellow, and he gets more intelligent, and he gets more able, and he's happier, and he... What's the pitch? course, with running security checks all the time on PCs that come up the line, what's the pitch? Well, there his question becomes totally unanswerable because we're running ourselves out as auditors, philosophers, teachers, or anything else. Of course, if you can't make a thetan commit tremendous numbers of overts against you, or set him up in a situation where he can commit tremendous overts against you, and then remove any possibility if he's ever running the overts, that's the only way you can actually overwhelm him, and so get him so stamped down with a valence that he can't thereafter wriggle. You see that? So these former efforts were entrapments, and this is not an entrapment. It is not even a total freedom. I've even told you occasionally, total freedom would be existence without barriers, and I think you would find everybody very miserable. All right. We're an incomprehensible factor. This is the first time, actually, a high-powered, rather selfless philosophy has hit Earth, which didn't at once demand of its practitioner, or the person who embraces it, that he totally subjugate himself utterly and become enslaved by the philosophy, don't you see? And which didn't say that the originator of the philosophy must then be carried as an imperishable valence from there on to the end of the track, and everybody should bow down to this, don't you see? That alone is incomprehensible amongst the works of men. These are different. And these are the differences that man becomes alarmed at, because he's certain that if there's this much, and you neglect these obvious factors, which he sort of senses you neglect, there must be some much deeper, much more vicious motive mixed up in all this. You see? And they become quite excited. And recently, some chap out in California took his finger off his PC and probably didn't flatten the process. The PC went out and assaulted her husband on the street and had him arrested, and tried to have the auditor arrested, and signed a check over to him. The police raided the building and took his e-meters and tapes and made the usual mules south ends out of themselves, because I like horses. and went ramming around madly, you see. Now look at the hysteria. Look at the hysteria. They sent a telex to every police department in the state of California about this terrible case that they had just uncovered. What terrible case? Well, with a good attorney on the job, and this thing sorted out, and everybody keeping calm about the thing, and not fighting it violently, but just putting up a consistent and continual effective pressure against that particular attack angle, and it will not wind up in 30 days, I assure you. Courts are not rigged that way. Nor will it wind up in 60 days, nor 180 days. You will still be hearing about this in about 3 years. And there is never any reason to rush any place and do anything about characters like that. What you do is just put up a steady pressure in that particular direction. Just take the effective actions and let it coast. Do not become absorbed in it, because it is out of terror that the attack is born, and people who are in terror make mistakes. And all we do is just don't make any mistakes, and continue to put up an effective pressure against this sphere. And investigate loudly is one of the things we do. We have a regular modus operandi. And these people become more and more terrified because they now begin to feel guilty of an overt act. I saw the president of a law university who had me arrested one time as a witness in a bankruptcy. You see, in the United States, if you're a witness in a bankruptcy in a federal court, you can be arrested, because you're liable not to witness, you see. They even fingerprint you, you know. It's very degrading. Witnesses in bankruptcies, that has to do with money, and after all the money in a bankruptcy belongs to the attorneys and the judge. And you can't you can't go around being a witness lightly, you see. And these fellows, the only way they could be coaxed, and the judge could be coaxed, and everybody could be coaxed, was to issue this silly witness in a bankruptcy warrant. He said, that's totally meaningless, you know. You see an accident happen, and in New York City, the cops can grab hold of you and put you in jail for 3 days. As a consequence, accidents and murder happen in broad daylight in New York City, and you just ask anybody around you what was going on, and they look at you rather searchingly and don't answer. And you say, is there anything that happened on this corner? And the fellow said, no, I wasn't here. His 20 cigarette butts littered around his feet. He wasn't there, he just arrived. You can't get anybody to interfere in New York City or witness anything in New York City just because of these silly witness rules. Anyway, the president of a law school had been employed to obtain this warrant, and the chief federal United States Marshal, I think they have a sort of a feeling like they're still Western Marshals or something. They go around with big guns hanging on them and so forth. The only trouble is they normally pick people off Skid Row to have these jobs, and it's rather incongruous, you see. Yeah. And this fellow, he was utterly mad dogging because he was sure that I'd just beaten up two of his marshals. Actually, I hadn't beaten up a marshal. I'd taken the gun away from one and told him how to use it and put it back in his holster. Because I thought he would get into trouble. I explained it to him. I said, you'll get in trouble waving that about and so forth. And this is the hammer and this is the trigger. And he handed it over to me and I said, these are the butt plates and there's the ammunition and so forth. And slid the cartridges out of the chamber and put him in his pocket and put the gun back. Told nobody was picking on him and it was all right. And he did it. You think I'm kidding you, but he did it. People that walk up to you shaking and nerves with a drawn cocked gun, you don't monkey that sort of thing. Teach them how to use it. Anyway, this was pretty wild. This was years and years and years ago. It was clear back in 52. Anyway, these guys began to realize that, one, they were not dealing with a criminal, that somebody had told them some lies, and they gradually ran up little white flags, and they became more and more apologetic, and more and more apologetic, and in the course of about 3 or 4 days, finally took me down to the court where I was supposed to give my testimony, and I sat down, and I said, yes, I knew of this company. Yes, my relationships with this company was so-and-so. No, I didn't have any money from this company, and that was it. Oh, yes, and I said, I don't even have any money now. And that was it, and that was the end of my testimony. The judge, however, he heard some rumors, you see, that two U.S. federal marshals had been beaten up, and so on. And he said, screaming, and I won't blast the microphone, but isn't there anything on which I can hold this man? Isn't there anything? You see, he'd been told by everybody this guy had a new idea, and therefore I'd be shot, you see. And the federal marshal and the president of the law university ran, they did not walk, they ran up the aisle to the front of the judge's bench. And they said, no, no, Your Honor, this is a perfectly decent man. You've got the whole idea all wrong. And they were just interrupting each other. And no, no, Your Honor, you don't want this man. He didn't have anything to do with that. And you have been improperly informed and so forth. And this whole thing is a mistake. And you must let him go right now. There's nothing else you can hold him for, and there's no reason to hold him. And they came back and they said, you know, you ought to do something about it. You shouldn't let people say bad things about you like this, because it's a terrible mistake. And they escorted me out and took me down to my airplane, by the way, in a gold-plated limousine as near as they could make it, you know. Shook my hand and so forth. Sure was terrible what mistakes people could make, namely them. So when they run that many over, they get propitiative. And when people are in terror, they make mistakes. Now let me tell you the denouement of the last attack on Scientology through the law courts in Washington, D.C. The witness in this particular case would not state that he had not been financed in all of his attacks on Scientology by the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, and the American Medical Association. This was the one question he wouldn't answer. He would answer questions to the effect of, yes, he had been in jail. Yes, he had been in insane asylums. Yes, he was wanted for this or that crime in various states. Yes, he'd answer these questions, but he wouldn't answer this one question. Was his whole attack financed by the American Psychiatric Association and the American Medical Association? That question he refused to answer. Now, of course, in a regular trial, he would have to answer that question, but his witness deposition was simply being taken in open court, and he could not be forced to answer all the questions. But when he was finally, when the whole thing came up for trial, he would have to answer those questions. Now, he was attacking us. We weren't attacking him. He was suing us for false arrest. He kept calling up the office and doing various things around and about the place, having swindled the organization out of about $15,000. I took my finger off my dollars for a second, and there the organization's dollars, and there it went. And then, because he was arrested for pulling this, he was arrested in the wrong county or something. There are several counties, and nobody can quite tell which county is which there at that corner of Maryland. So they arrested him in the wrong side of some line. So therefore, he had this fantastic charge of false arrest that he could bring about, don't you see? Look, this kept going for nearly 3 years. Well, there were nerves during all these 3 years. There were people investigating things and calling things up and doing all kinds of things. For 3 years, there were people, you were hiring attorneys and hiring detectives and listening to reports and so forth. For 3 years, the man's name, by the way, is Edelman. And the Edelman case is very much in point. 3 years, this goes on. Every principal in the Washington organization was being sued for a minimum of $100,000 cash. Well, you'd say that ought to make you nervous, man. That's a lot of money. 3 years. Marilyn and Sue and myself, anybody else connected with it. Everybody was sued for $100,000 cash. As a matter of fact, the only one who got any satisfaction out of it was Susie, and she, I think, knocked the attorney silly. He tried to attack me in the lobby, and I knew better than to hit him. It was a great temptation, you see. He was not very big, and they were serving a warrant, you know, right in the middle of a Congress. And it was a great temptation, and I was gripping my hands rather tightly in my pocket so that I wouldn't succumb to it, because all he needed, you see, was an assault charge. Then he would have had it, you see, he would have had it made. But evidently, even he realized it was silly to bring a suit against a woman for assault. Mary Sue wouldn't have anybody talking to me that way, and she clobbered him about three times. He sort of looked at her like, you shouldn't have done it, you know. Wrong attacker. Well, anyhow, after all of this nonsense and cops and robbers and everything else that you could think of, you see, 3 years worth of it, considerable expenses in courts and all that sort of thing. Finally, it comes up, the great day for trial. The great day for trial has now arrived, and Edelman is there spinning as usual and being paid to say this and that and the other thing, and everything is all set and raring to go, and the judge who should have dismissed it, he should have dismissed it 2 years before, because they kept altering the bill on him. You see, they kept altering the statement of charges, Edelman's attorney did. And it was very illegal, but he still didn't throw it out. Everything had gone wrong. And we were all there. That is, I wasn't there, but the representative of the organization was there. Marilyn actually was there. And our attorneys, and all is raised and waiting on the fall of the gavel. And we look everywhere in vain, but Edelman's attorney has failed to turn up. And has forgotten that it was this day supposed to be held. Of course, the judge dismissed the case, and the attorney Houston couldn't even get it reinstated again. After 3 years. If you wait them out long enough, they sooner or later will make a mistake. That's all it amounts to, if you just go on being effective. Now, the only thing that can be done to a Scientology organization or a Scientology personnel is to be worried, to a point where he doesn't do his job, either in an organization or an individual auditor. Now remember that. That's all that can happen to you. You can be worried and harassed and upset to a point where you are made ineffective. And the whole gain of the people who oppose new ideas is then by making one or more organizations or Scientologists temporarily ineffective. You got it? All the time you spend on this, of course, is lost time. And the more you worry about it, is lost worry. Go ahead and be effective, but remember, the only thing they will ever gain in the long run, they have never yet thrown anybody in the clink, you know. I mean, it's just all yipple-yapple. They never can. They never have any evidence. It's just the amount of time you lose in worrying about it. You understand? And the amount of dispatch time you absorb and the cost of cables and attorneys. You got that? That's the whole loss. That's all that ever happens. It is the lost time of a Scientologist, one or more, being rendered ineffective for a period of time and being tied up and worried because he's involved in some kind of a yickle-yackle. The way to fool them is go on and be effective with regard to them and go on being effective as a Scientologist. Go on being effective in an organization. Go on running things effectively, keeping the show on the road, in other words, and just don't fall for the only loss that you can be thrown for, which is to lose your own time and forward pressure, you see, and a little money one way or the other. That's the only thing you can lose. Well, now, if you go ahead and concentrate 1,000% and put everything on a high emergency priority basis, of course, all that is wasted motion and action. And the more you indulge in it, and the more you worry about it, the less Scientology you get done, so it's only to that degree that the enemy wins. They get a negative gain. They take one organization, or one personnel, or one auditor, or something, and they move him out of the lineup for a short period of time, and maybe blunt a little bit of his enthusiasm, because he says the world is an evil place after all. That is the sole thing they can win. They can't win anything else. And of course, if they're going to play a game like this, and we have no other choice than to play some of this game, I always ask myself, by the way, what game is this that is being played? Sort it out pretty well. Find out what game is being played here. And then find out if it's our game. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, that if it is not our game, there are no marbles of mine lying in the ring. There are no cricket bats out there on the green that have my name on them. They can go ahead and box with their own shadows and climb mythical ropes and do anything they want to do, but they're not playing a game with us. You understand? But I will go ahead and do the effective things. These effective things usually get very competent assistance and get it fast. Force people to accept our assistance. That is to say, if somebody's being attacked, don't let him avoid our help. The only time we lose, or the only time anybody loses, is when they avoid our help. You know, they say, well, really, I probably shouldn't have any help from HCO or something like this because it's all possibly very bad and it'll all wind up bad. And they do, they lose. There have been one or two minor little cases where they did lose badly. Or they don't say anything that is at all bright. If it's totally outside of our perimeter of control, something like a knucklehead one time down in Phoenix keeps going in and saying, I practice Dianetics, I don't practice Scientology. He wasn't. He hadn't practiced Dianetics in his whole lifetime. He didn't even know how to run an engram. The only thing he could be cuffed around for, told not to practice, was Dianetics. So he keeps telling everybody that he practices Dianetics. We keep telling him, for God's sake, shut your mouth. Tell people you practice Scientology. No, he couldn't do that, so we couldn't help that man. And there was a fellow out in Australia, around Perth and so forth, and he wouldn't even accept an attorney, he wouldn't accept anything. All he got was a small fine. But he just wouldn't accept a thing. And we even knew things about the person who was bringing the charges and the doctor bringing the charges and so forth. that were practically unprintable, but very provable. And he wouldn't let us enter any of these things, nothing like that. So we lost in that particular sphere. Now, how much time can be developed by one of these attacks? That is, how much time can be involved by one of these attacks? Plenty. Morale can be shot. Various things can happen and so forth. Friends, we've never had a day's worry, really, about the government since I told the Food and Drug Administration in Washington, D.C. to go fly a kite, if they knew how, if they had intelligence to read a book about flying kites. And the way I did it is I read their law, and I found out that if you manufactured anything that came under their purview, then your whole organization was under their authority, which is quite interesting. As if we manufactured an e-meter, they were in charge of all e-meters, because obviously an e-meter is both food and drugs. That's the way the law reads. That outfit passes psychiatric machines which kill people, murders them. I'm not lightly stating it. No, it does. They have shorts in them. They're ineffective electrical equipment. Completely aside from being a shock machine, they are badly made. And the Food and Drug Administration has purview of those things, and they let them go on killing people. But that's all right with the Food and Drug Administration. But somebody has an e-meter. They said the e-meter was a diagnostic therapeutic instrument and was used to cure people of things. And the small current that went through it titillated or agitated the brain and made the brain cells well or something. I don't know what they hadn't figured out. So we just stopped selling e-meters, and we stopped selling these dianazine anti-radiation bombs because people kept asking for them, you know, the little pills. And we just quit that, and the Food and Drug Administration said, you shouldn't have done that. But I also caused him an enormous amount of work, and I imagine our name is an anathema to him. Because every time I turn around, I had him writing letters to senators and congressmen explaining why he was attacking this church. A poor man, the head of the Food and Drug Administration, with all of his administration, had to write additional letters all the time. We turned them out on robotypes ourselves. They all looked like personal letters. They weren't. And then the senator would write him and say, what is this? And then he'd have to write a long explanation. Part of his text was, you remember, of course, L. Ron Hubbard, because he's the one that's had so much publicity in recent years. He always included this phrase in his letters to the senators and congressmen. They, of course, would instantly forward his letters to us. We just set it up on an administrative line. It just went off 1, 2, 3, 4. We were worrying them to death. And then all of a sudden, when I found this clause in the law that said that they had no purview over you if you didn't manufacture anything out of which they had any purview. Okay? But if you did manufacture, then they could run your whole organization for you. So I just kicked these items out of our immediate sales bill, and that's why they're not there anymore, and the Food and Drug Administration had to go away and get lost. All right, and they did, because it wasn't our game. So my cricket bat was no longer lying on the green, don't you see? And their poor, unemployed agents had to wander and go to movies in the afternoon instead of... But the only thing you can lose... The only thing you can lose is your time and your equanimity. That's all. And if you rig it up so these things are not disturbed and you have gone on being effective the whole time and taking very effective steps to handle this all and square this all around and realize fully that there is nothing wastes as much time as the law. You see, the law has overts against men's time. It puts them in jail. Overt against time. So, of course, the law slowed down to a point where to get a civil suit tried of having bought a package of biscuits at the store, which was moldy, and you're suing the store, that will be heard in 2 or 3 years, you see. That's the way the law goes. But because it's overt against time, it goes this way. All right, now, don't worry for a minute about the future health of Scientology. It is going through these exact periods that every new idea goes through. It is actually being fought much less expertly than many things have been fought in the past. There are tremendous things which could be done, but I've begun to realize that nobody is going to do them. So I never bother to provide against them anymore, to amount to anything. But there are some sleepers back on the track. If anybody tried to attack a Scientology organization and pick it up and move it out of the perimeter, go over the hills with it today, this happened to us once. why, they would find themselves involved in the most confoundedly weird mess of legal, well, it's just like quicksand. Quicksand, it's an interesting trick. Every time they shoot at you on the right side of the horse, you're on the left side of the horse. And then they prove conclusively you're on the left side of the horse, you prove conclusively that you're on the right side of the horse. And they go mad after a while. This is what the basic legal structure is. Furthermore, Scientology is so fixed up these days that if any one continent shut down, the enemy realizes much better than you do, because it's happened, that any area so closed off could be flooded from an exterior source. Understand? So it doesn't do any good to close any area of Scientology out in the whole world, and no agency exists which could do so. You see how that would work? They might close them all out in the United States, they might close them all out in England, but their apathy comes about at once by the fact that if they closed them out in the United States, they would be bombarded from England. And if they closed them out in England, they'd be bombarded from the United States. And in the United States, the difficulty is that if they attacked in one state, they'd find you operating in another state, don't you see? That isn't the same corporation that you're attacking, you see? It's all very involved. But and this drives, by the way, the Better Business Bureau berserk. They know what they want. They're mainly subsidized, by the way, by the American Medical Association. They're always putting out tracts about quack medicines and all this sort of thing. They blackmail you, and we never buy blackmail. It's another one of our defensive mechanisms. We never pay blackmail. Drive us to the wall, shoot us down, but we won't pay blackmail. That's it. And people realize this, and it's very upsetting to them. So the upshot of all this is there is an unpleasant side to the business of dissemination, and that is the backlash. And it's a very interested backlash, but a very terrified one. It used to be a ridiculing backlash, but now it isn't. There is fear in it. There is more than fear in the United States in it. I had a fellow investigating Scientology for the government. He was told to by the White House, so he didn't dare do anything but actually investigate it. Finally, he was looking more and more whipped, and more and more whipped, and more and more whipped. And he finally picked out one profile showing a bottom to the top again. And he said, if just this one profile were ever published in the American Journal of Psychology, it would upset the whole field. You realize that? And the other fellow says, yes, well, we don't really blame you for keeping it all to yourself and keeping a monopoly on it. Keeping it all to ourselves. Just let anybody stand still long enough to listen, a Scientologist will give him the works, you know. And yet psychology was upset because we kept it all to ourselves. No, at no time have we ever really faltered. Now, since about 1953, we've been going pretty good since 53. Up to that time, we had no corporate control. People say what I did before 1953. Well, what I did before 1953 was try to keep the show on the roads and fight them off single-handed. And after a while, why, we got enough people in line so that it wasn't quite this tough. And that's really what happened. And now, on a present time, our modus operandi is so well worked out that an attack in one quarter of the United States brings about a certain series of actions in an entirely different quarter in the United States, and suddenly why the enemy is looking at all kinds of attorneys and looking at various backflashes, and now an investigation has been started of the people who are behind this attack on Scientology. And that investigation will go forward. These people will be very discredited before we get through. Don't think that this is an N-theta operating atmosphere. It is not one. I'm trying to tell you what we do to fight back and what we do to keep going. And that is to say, above all else, we keep on doing our jobs. And we're effective in combating the attack. And just remember those two factors while you've got it. Be effective in combating the attack. Don't let it keep you from doing your job. That's the only thing the enemy can win. And all else is of no consequence. Frankly, Not for years has anybody been hurt in one of these attacks. Not for years and years and years. I first laid down the modus operandi of what to do about it. Various ones have been laid down about 1955, and they've been uniformly successful since that time. I haven't got any wood to knock on particularly, but I do have a lot of faith on Scientology and Scientologists. I've got a lot of that to knock on. That's good. All right, well, that's a long dissertation, which you probably feel didn't have too much to do with you. But it's something for you to look at and realize that you would be as nothing. What you would be doing would not even be important if nobody fought you anywhere, if nobody disapproved of what we were doing anywhere. You realize it would be like reaching into a soundless void. Think of the thousands of philosophies that must have been developed in all parts of Earth by 2.5 billion human beings in the past 11 years. There must have been quite a few. There have been rivers of books written, all of which had new, startling, and strange ideas. None of these are ever fought, not one of them. And nobody's ever heard of them. But we have the enemy, aberration, ignorance, enslavement. We have these things on the run. And the hallmark of having them on the run is that somebody gets excited about it. Right now, the American Medical Association, I don't know what their mood would be today if you walked in, opened the front door, and walked in, receptionist, said, I'm a Scientologist. I'm sure you wouldn't be unknown. They might try to pretend they didn't know you. But that's it. Yes?
A couple of years ago, Ron, a man who didn't want his girlfriend processed wrote a letter to the American Medical Association. Got a letter back from their secretary saying, these seem to be fine, earnest people who are in a totally different field from the field of medicine, so they give us no trouble and we give them none.
Oh, is that so?
Right.
Well, that's how far it's gone. I wish I had a copy of that letter. We've just received the surrender papers of the Better Business Bureau. They're sort of written backwards, but they're nevertheless that. But there's the point. As you move forward in life, and as you move forward across the face of man's thought fields, particularly, think of the hospitals, think of the vested interests, think of the utterly billions of dollars and pounds that are undoubtedly invested in education in all these different spheres of facilities. Why, I think if you put together all the electrodiathermy machines that won't cure anybody out here in this 10-acre park, they'd probably make an awfully nice mess of a mountain. When you think of all this vested interest, when you think of the electronic organization, when you think of the drug people, you think of all these vested interests. Think of what they'd lose. It's fantastic. I think they're being gentlemen about it myself. I think they're so on. They eventually will turn over the sword, and that will be the end of that. But if you weren't fought, and if you didn't have backflashes, and if you didn't hear wild rumors of one character or another running around the field, start worrying. Start worrying. Right then, start worrying. Because you're not getting through. What do you think the highest level of approval of the human race is right now? What would it be? Yeah. But when you don't hear any of it, no, you aren't being heard. Okay? Well, I didn't mean to give you such a lugubrious talk on the situation, but it's been a bit on my mind. I thought you might know something about it, how we are alert to these things and what we do concerning them, and why you don't find me tearing myself wrong side out every time somebody jumps up. But where you do find this, you do find us doing something effective. We move in rather rapidly. Our communication lines are much more rapid than the enemy's. Much more rapid. They're very fast. The speed of HCO's communication lines is your best guarantee of defense. And that's why you must keep the speed of HCO lines up. They must be rapid, and there mustn't be any comm lags on them, whether there's anything important going over them or not. Keep them up. Because this alone is very discouraging to people. very upsetting. They think we'll hear about it in a month or two and maybe do something about it. When within something like hours after this incident happened, anybody with authority in Scientology knew all about it within hours after the thing occurred. And of course they just started moving up various artillery units and that sort of thing and lining up things one way or the other. And you've got some isolated unit that was making an attack on a Scientologist, and he's going to wonder what the hell cooks after a while. Now, of course, the backfire is going on the basis that, in view of fact, every police agency in California has been informed of this terrible case and these terrible people. Well, naturally, they've made it inevitable that we have to get them investigated thoroughly. And so that is happening. And the next police report that I expect to come through on this line probably won't be through for almost a year. It'll be somewhat on the basis of this. You remember that case in Eureka? What case? Well, the case about the Scientologists up in Eureka, you know, how they were drugging everybody and so forth. Well, I think this case we're into right here in Portland, which will have something to do with nothing connected with us, you see, I think it's similar to that. Yeah, I think it's just similar to that Eureka case. Remember? And they'll be using it as a model of comparison of how to subvert an organization, you see, only we won't be the people they will be saying we're bad. It'll be somebody else on this thing. Well, those are good things to know. I'm giving a talk about it because I see that once in a while your judgment can be startled on something like this. You hear some fantastic rumor of some kind or another. You say, well, there must be truth in it. Couldn't be otherwise. No, the only truth is we're making progress. You never get rumors when we're being ineffective. If we're not getting wins on cases and HGCs and academies aren't good and that sort of thing, you know, we never hear a thing about us. It's all of a sudden, though, we go into a wild wing ding, a clearing them left and right and straighten out organizations and so forth, and the enemy says, oh my God, there they go again, you see? And I use as a positive indicator of the strength of a central organization whether or not it's got any backlash. Is anybody yelling about it? Is anybody complaining about it? Is anybody screaming about it? And if there is nobody, I say they must all be sitting there doing nothing. They can't possibly be getting any results in the academy. They can't possibly be getting any results in the HGC. They can't possibly be doing a blessed thing because nobody's worried. But you give me a big flood of letters coming in from someplace saying those dogs down in Sydney are just doing the terriblest things and everything is bad in Sydney and Sydney is terribly bad, I'll forward it through for information. I'll even look into it a little bit. But the basic thing that registers with me is somebody in Sydney is being effective. That's the thing to remember on these things. And I received a letter today asking me to return Ken quite rapidly so they could do something about this. I'm putting it in this proper perspective. It's much more important that Ken finish off some effectiveness. You see, by withdrawing him from course, we immediately make ourselves less effective. See, California be less effective. You get how we lose that way. In addition to that, people have a grandiose notion that this is going to take place, that something is going to happen. Nothing is going to happen. It's going to go on for months and months and months. It'll leave somebody sitting on the hot seat for months and months and months. 1962 will come and go. 1963 will arrive. And still, nothing drastic will have happened. Okay? That's the status of rumor. That's the status of combat with the society. When there's nothing to lean on, there's nobody listening. If there's nothing flashing back, there are no ears hearing you, nor eyes seeing what you're doing. So I don't care how much N theta you stir up. Just be effective. Thank you.